Lyme disease has been on my radar for quite a long time now, since I've known so many people that have suffered quite a bit from it. It still amazes me that a tiny little critter the size of a pinhead can cause so much trouble. The good news is that Lyme is finally recognized as a legitimate disease that has a wide range of symptoms. In years past, even if you could get a doctor to test for it, the testing was not particularly reliable, and you could easily wander around for many more months or years before getting treatment. While it is still hard to get diagnosed, unless you find the tick feasting on your blood, it is much easier than before. And the standard of care seems to have shifted so the doctors are more likely to treat, even without complete proof of the disease. While I don't like to take antibiotics, having witnessed the long-term effects of late-to-diagnose Lyme disease, I'm willing to take the dose and add some probiotics to my diet if I suspect I have Lyme. We have three articles to read today, all of which relate to tick-borne illnesses. The first comes from Al Jazeera of April 15, 2020, and is written by Sarah Katz. This is titled, Lyme Disease, the Other Epidemic No One is Talking About. As articles about the coronavirus pandemic flood my Facebook feed and the numbers of people sick and dead climb, I'm experiencing deja vu. I first felt the dread associated with dealing with an epidemic 20 years ago when I was 11 years old and living with my family of six in a wooded suburban neighborhood in North Potomac, Maryland. It was the year 2000, and one morning my mother shouted uncharacteristically from her bedroom down the hall. Startled, I raced in to find her confronting her reflection in the bathroom mirror. "I can't move this side of my face," she slurred, pointing to her right side. Still bleary with sleep, her right eye and corner of her mouth drooped, as if they had suddenly become too heavy for her. Half of her flushed face was mysteriously paralyzed. Her experience of Bell's palsy was just a new bullet point in an elongating list of symptoms of a then undiagnosed condition that my typically healthy 41-year-old mother endured that year. After months of malaise, shooting pains throughout her body, dizziness, vomiting, leg paralysis, and inaccurate speculations by doctors about whether she had kidney disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, thyroid disease, or a mental illness, an infectious disease doctor finally diagnosed her with neurological Lyme disease, which is caused by the spiral-shaped bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi and spread by deer ticks. Due to the seriousness and progression of the disease, she received 6 weeks of intravenous treatment, a year of antibiotics, and a year of physical therapy. Lyme disease upended my family's life as suddenly as COVID-19 has affected families around the world, with no warning and, as we would soon discover, leaving a long trail of damage in its wake. Almost as soon as my mother recovered, my father also contracted Lyme disease. He woke up one day with numbness in his arms, excruciating nerve pain throughout his body, and puzzling neurological symptoms including confusion, memory issues, and distorted vision. After blood tests came back overwhelmingly positive for Lyme, he too received an IV for 6 weeks, as well as 2.5 years of oral antibiotic treatment. His symptoms did not abate until a decade later. My three siblings were next. As I concerned myself with the activities of a teenager in high school, chores, studying, playing recreational football, and hanging out with friends, my twin brother and younger sisters shuffled in and out of doctor appointments, complaining of fevers, aches, and malaise. My brother also experienced serious memory issues and joint pain, which undermined his academic performance. After missing several days of school, they were diagnosed with Lyme disease and another tick-borne illness, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, respectively, treated with antibiotics, and eventually recovered. At 16, depressed and wearied by the pressure of standing in as a caregiver while my family members convalesced, I finally caught up with them. A doctor attributed my chronic daily headaches and rashes to Lyme disease and successfully treated me with antibiotics, too. We all recovered physically from these diseases long ago, but the anxiety of living with an invisible enemy never fully dissipated. I spend less time outside than I used to. I'm obsessed with identifying every dark speck on my body. And now that another invisible enemy has arrived, I am wiping packages, groceries, and counters with familiar alertness. Although most would not know it due to long-standing controversy within the medical community, as well as the lack of media attention, Lyme disease has, like COVID-19, mushroomed into a global epidemic. It is the most common vector-borne illness in the United States, with 30,000 cases reported to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention each year by state health departments, although experts believe true numbers are at least 10 times higher. The numbers also do not reflect the prevalence of post-treatment Lyme disease, a case of Lyme that does not improve after the usual course of antibiotics, which affects as many as 2 million people in the U.S. alone. Some scientists say the number of Americans infected by Lyme eclipses the number of Americans diagnosed with breast cancer, HIV, and hepatitis C combined. Certainly, the diseases do not compare. COVID-19 is extremely contagious and spreads from person to person, while only infected ticks are known to transmit Lyme and other tick-borne diseases to people. Also, COVID-19 symptoms appear limited, whereas Lyme symptoms vary from person to person, depending on the stage, the etiology of the disease, or the particular strain of bacteria. Most frightening about COVID-19 is the respiratory problems it can cause, whereas Lyme, in its late stages, can damage the brain or heart. Still, as the U.S. government holds one news briefing after another about the COVID-19 pandemic, I see how the CDC has bungled its response to both outbreaks in similar ways. The agency developed restrictive diagnostic criteria that led to the underreporting of COVID-19 initially, just as it limits diagnoses of Lyme disease to those who meet certain criteria. As a result, my family coped for months, possibly years, with a disease without immediate answers. How is a person supposed to get better if a doctor who should be in a position to know cannot diagnose you, or assumes that you are mentally ill rather than physically sick? As people in the U.S. struggle to get tested for COVID-19, I'm thinking of the difficulty of getting tested for Lyme disease. Although Lyme first appeared in the medical literature more than four decades ago in 1975, there is still no reliable way to test people for the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. The blood tests we do have test not for the bacteria, but for the body's antibody response to the bacteria, which, when used early on in the infection, comes back negative until antibodies rise to detectable levels. Without the tests, a doctor can make an early diagnosis on seeing the characteristic rash, which sometimes looks like a bullseye. However, it does not always appear. It did not for me, my brother, or my parents. And sometimes it can be hidden in hair. As a result, many who are infected go undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, which can lead to worse or ineffective treatment outcomes. Lyme can even be deadly. There is also no treatment yet for COVID-19, and while there is one for Lyme disease, it is not always successful, even when infected patients are diagnosed in the early stage of the disease. While many studies show an approximately 20% treatment failure rate, a Johns Hopkins University study showed that 39% of patients with early Lyme continued experiencing symptoms 6 months after treatment. Yet the guidelines for treating Lyme disease have not changed in decades. With trials for a COVID-19 vaccine underway, it is hard for me to feel enthusiastic when there is no Lyme disease vaccine on the market. While one pandemic grows, another is growing unchecked. I am heartened by individuals, automobile companies, and clothing designers rallying to hand-make personal protective equipment and other medical equipment for healthcare professionals. For all the gloom and doom that surrounds us, this is an opportunity for all of us to examine how we live, what we value, and whether our behaviors have reflected those values. When all this is over, can we harness the same energy we're giving to a fast-moving threat to slower-moving ones, like Lyme disease and climate change? Can we stop minimizing what is avoidable and foreseeable from a distance? Can we continue to demonstrate social responsibility going forward? as I spoke with family members to get their recollections on our experience with Lyme disease, I realized how long it had been since the last time we talked about it. For us, those years were a time of confusion and alienation, and we buried them, even as they manifested in our current lives in other ways. Some people did not believe us at the time when we explained our symptoms and how the disease had ravaged our family. Sometimes, we did not even believe ourselves. But this time is different. Now, as we read about other families all around us coping with an invisible disease while in quarantine, we somehow feel less isolated. It is as if the pandemic validated our earlier experience with an epidemic and reignited that desire to understand it, mitigate it, and join a larger response to it. With kids of his own now, my brother says he now sees his family as interconnected with everyone else's. "This time I've had at home with my family is something I'm never going to forget," he told me over email. "We've grown closer than ever in these past few weeks, and I wouldn't trade it for the world." We have an article from the New York Times Magazine, and this is by Lisa Sanders, MD, in the Diagnosis column, published on July 15th, 2020, and titled, "She Tested Negative for Lyme Disease, So What Was Wrong?" The 50-year-old physician dropped into the leather chair in her psychiatrist's Manhattan office. Her new normal, she announced to Dr. Deborah Cabanis, was constant fatigue. Cabanis noted that although her patient looked put together as usual, she could see the exhaustion in her eyes. "You don't look like yourself," the therapist agreed. The patient had seen Cabanis for more than a decade. She valued the sessions as a chance to talk about the stresses of balancing a medical practice with the demands of family. But since a few months earlier, all the patient could talk about was how awful she felt. Her summer had gotten off to a great start. She spent Memorial Day weekend in 2019 with her children at her family's beach house in the Hamptons on Long Island. Then she traveled with friends to Tanzania and Uganda. She saw all kinds of wildlife and even swam in Lake Tanganyika. But not long after she returned home, she started to feel sick. She'd gone with her family to the beach house for the 4th of July weekend. While she was there, she spiked a fever of 102. She spent most of the holiday in bed with chills and drenching sweats, interrupted by occasional bouts of diarrhea. After that weekend, she never felt well. Every 2 weeks, her fever came back for a couple of days. It didn't make her sick enough to stay in bed, but she had to drag herself to meet her obligations to her patients and her family. Between these fevers, she was constantly exhausted. Every joint ached. The diarrhea persisted. She went to see her primary care doctor, who immediately sent off a series of blood tests to look for Lyme disease and a couple of other common tick-borne infections endemic to the region. The doctor also sent a blood smear to look for malaria. Although the patient had taken the recommended medicine to prevent infection in East Africa, some types of malaria are resistant. All the test results were negative. The patient called one of her teachers from medical school, a specialist in infectious diseases, who recommended testing for other diseases she might have been exposed to in East Africa, including schistosomiasis, an infection transmitted by the snails in Lake Tanganyika, and other diseases carried by mosquitoes, like chikungunya fever. Again, all the tests were negative. By September, the fevers abated, but she still had the full-body joint pain, the devastating fatigue, and the occasional cramps and diarrhea. She saw a gastroenterologist. When he couldn't find anything, he prescribed a 2-week course of an antibiotic called rifaximin for a suspected intestinal infection. Her diarrhea improved, but nothing else did. Cabanis had been reluctant to offer her patient any non-psychiatric advice, but that day, seeing her so sick and still without a diagnosis, the therapist decided to speak up. A colleague of hers ran a center specializing in tick-borne diseases at Columbia University, she told her patient. If her illness wasn't something she picked up in Africa, maybe it was something she brought home from the Hamptons. The next day, the patient made an appointment to see Dr. Brian Fallon, director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Diseases Research Center. Fallon trained as a psychiatrist, but early in his career in the 1990s, his interest in neuropsychiatric conditions led him to focus on a multi-system infectious disease caused by a bacterium known as Borrelia burgdorferi, Lyme disease. Fallon is a slender man with a tidy salt-and-pepper beard and a soft-spoken manner. The patient briskly outlined the events of the past few months, then described her current symptoms. She had no energy for anything and went to bed right after dinner most nights. She slept, but never felt rested. And once she got out of bed, every joint in her body ached. It was the worst in her hands. "Both hands?" Fallon asked. "Yes." And it was a different kind of pain from the many sports injuries she'd had. All she wanted was to feel herself again. Fallon spent nearly an hour getting the rest of her medical history, but by the end of the visit, he wasn't at all certain this was Lyme or any tick-borne infection. They can all cause fever and fatigue, but the joint pain in Lyme, the most common of these diseases, was usually limited to one side. Two other common tick-borne infections, ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis, can produce similar syndromes of fever, fatigue, and body pain, but are usually far more severe. Babesia, a parasite transmitted by the tick that carries both ehrlichiosis and Lyme disease, was possible, but that infection destroys red blood cells, causing severe anemia along with fever and malaise. Fallon ordered the extensive panel of tests used in his center to look for other infections that ticks can cause. Because her symptoms weren't typical, Fallon also ordered tests to investigate other possibilities. Rheumatoid arthritis, RA, often causes joint pain that can be worse in the hands. Celiac disease, an autoimmune disorder, can cause this combination of gastrointestinal distress and joint pain. He also checked her thyroid hormones, her red blood cell count, and calcium level. The results came back over the next couple of weeks. She wasn't anemic. Her calcium was normal. It wasn't her thyroid. She didn't have celiac disease or RA. She didn't have Lyme disease either, nor did she have babesiosis or ehrlichiosis. Only one result was positive. The test for a distant cousin of Borrelia burgdorferi, the bacterium that causes Lyme. It's called Borrelia miyamotoi, and it causes one of the newest tick-borne diseases. The first cases in Russia were reported in 2011. Cases were reported in the U.S. 2 years later. B. miyamotoi, like Lyme, is carried by the black-legged deer tick, but it's a much easier infection to get. With Lyme, the tick has to be attached to a body for 2 to 3 days before the bug can be transmitted. That's because B. burgdorferi lives deep in the tick's gut. But B. miyamotoi lives in the tick's mouth and can invade the body almost immediately. When untreated, B. miyamotoi can cause recurrent episodes of illness because of an unusual ability to fool the immune system by changing its outer layer. Once it has eluded our disease-fighting antibodies by the equivalent of changing clothes, it can reproduce again and produce a new round of fever, headache, fatigue, and body pain that characterize this as well as most other tick-borne infections. Fallon was a little surprised by the unusual result, but it made sense. The patient had been on Long Island, where there are many ticks, and she reported this unusual relapsing fever. He called her with the news. She was ecstatic to finally have an answer. The recommended treatment is 2 weeks of an antibiotic called doxycycline. Fallon had seen only a handful of cases of B. miyamotoi, and yet, based on research done by another scientist at the center, he knew that up to a quarter of the people who came for testing there had antibodies to M. miyamotoi, suggesting they had been infected with it previously. The only way he could explain this discrepancy was that sometime earlier, these patients had gone to their doctors with a febrile illness and a possible tick exposure and were treated for a presumed Lyme infection before the test results came back. Most tick-borne infections are treated with doxycycline. It was possible that the doctors and patients may have assumed the patients had Lyme disease even after the test came back negative, when actually they had B. myomotoi. Moreover, specific testing for B. myomotoi is not available at most labs at this point. The disease is just too new. The patient started feeling like herself again this spring. Because of COVID-19, they've had to skip their usual trips to the beach house for both Memorial Day and 4th of July weekends. Although the patient loves the tradition and the beach, she was happy to forgo it this year. We have time to read most of an article called 14 Lyme Disease Symptoms to Watch For, According to Doctors. And this is written by Karen Pallarito, published on June 25th, 2020, for Health. And boy, did they bury the 14 Lyme disease symptoms in the article deeply. Fever or fatigue, with or without a rash, can be a symptom of many things, and Lyme disease is just one possibility. To diagnose Lyme, doctors say they have to consider symptoms and circumstances. If you've been hanging out in wooded or grassy areas, especially in certain regions of the country during the spring, summer, or even autumn months, it might make sense to entertain the possibility that you were bitten by a tick. And what's the most commonly reported tick-borne illness in America? It's Lyme disease by far. But Timothy B. Flanagan, MD, Associate Professor of Medicine in the Infectious Diseases Division at Brown University's Alpert Medical School, says it would be a mistake to latch on to a Lyme diagnosis without ruling out other possible causes, including other infections transmitted by ticks. You could have a different tick-borne infection entirely, such as anaplasmosis or babesiosis, or you could have Lyme with one or more co-infections. That's because the same ticks that transmit Borrelia, the bacterium that causes Lyme, can carry other disease-causing microbes too. It's super important that we think of all the tick-borne diseases, not just Lyme, Dr. Flanagan tells Health. Babesia, a parasite that causes babesiosis, is treated differently than Borrelia, for example. Tick and Lyme disease symptoms, along with the patient history confirming or ruling out possible tick exposure, plus results of diagnostic testing when lab tests are indicated, can help your doctor arrive at a diagnosis, explains the CDC. Symptoms of Lyme disease in humans can be vague, and chances are you have no idea you've been bitten by an infected tick until symptoms surface. Ticks secrete an anesthetic that makes their bites painless, explains Christine Green, MD, a family physician in Mountain View, California, and a member of the Bay Area Lyme Foundation's Scientific Advisory Board. Plus, they're tiny. A young, immature tick, called a nymph, the stage of development during which these bloodsuckers are most likely to transmit Lyme disease, is roughly the size of a pinhead when it latches on. So you don't know it's there, she tells Health. According to the CDC, the incubation period for Lyme, in other words, the time between a person's exposure to Borrelia bacteria and symptom onset, ranges from 3 to 30 days. The main symptoms of Lyme disease in the early days and weeks after infection can include fever, rash, chills, headache, fatigue, muscle and joint aches, swollen lymph nodes. Often these people are more sick than you would expect from a cold, says Dr. Green. They're in the doctor's office in the middle of summer and they feel bad. They often do have headache or light sensitivity. Even new onset ringing in the ear can be a sign of Lyme, which can affect any cranial nerve, she says. Jenny Johnson, MD, an attending physician of infectious diseases at Providence, Rhode Island-based Lifespan, says knee swelling is common. They get a lot of fluid in the joint, and their joint gets big and swollen, and it's uncomfortable, she tells Health. Although many people look for a rash as a tip-off, it's entirely possible to have Lyme without a rash, or at least one that you didn't notice at the time. As for the other symptoms, Dr. Flanagan says they're highly variable and occur much more frequently with other tick-borne diseases. Ticks can settle into the skin folds, the groin and armpits, for instance. They can hide in the hair on your head and attach to areas you can't see or reach, like your back. As the infection spreads, people may develop more than one rash. What if Lyme disease isn't detected early on? The longer that disease-causing bacteria linger in the body, the more they disseminate. And as these microbes spread to tissues throughout the body, they can trigger a litany of symptoms. CDC says these may include severe headaches and neck stiffness, additional rashes. These lesions may pop up on other areas of the body. A type of facial paralysis known as Bell's palsy. Arthritis with severe joint pain and swelling. Knees and other large joints are vulnerable. Intermittent pain in tendons, muscles, joints, and bones. Nerve pain, shooting pains, numbness, or tingling in the hands or feet. You might have persistent or episodic symptoms, says Dr. Green. Pain that seems to move through the body? That's common too. The hallmark of late Lyme is migratory joint pain. Today, my right knee hurts, and tomorrow, I'm limping on my left ankle, and oh, my third finger of my right hand swelled up, and my neck has swelled up, she says. In rare cases, Lyme disease bacteria can enter the tissues of the heart. This complication, called Lyme carditis, can lead to lightheadedness, fainting, shortness of breath, heart palpitations, or chest pain. Doctors say the sooner you notice symptoms, the better your outcome. People treated in the early stages of Lyme generally make a full, rapid recovery, the CDC notes. Antibiotics are recommended for most people with Lyme disease, but what that regimen looks like varies widely from person to person. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases says a short course of an oral antibiotic such as doxycycline or amoxicillin can clear up Lyme infection in most cases. The bottom line, if you think you have symptoms of Lyme or another tick-borne disease, get evaluated and talk to your doctor about how to best treat the illness and manage ongoing symptoms. And that is, there were a few parts left out in that article, but I hope it still made sense the way it was. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay well, and please come back next week for more healthy living ideas.